stretching at the dawn of the day. All the darkened kittens, the mill of gray, all touched by the radiance that the sun discloses.
Oh, hear the people singing bread and roses.
That people say, well, no, first you need to teach the basics. Get to that icing on the cake. Get to that later thing. Here's no later. You don't take a 21-year-old adult and suddenly we're going to infuse you with these other elements that we consider to be important, not only at this particular juncture. It's like, for me, K through 12, right from the get-go, kids are getting access to this. We should have not only a theoretical working definition of these variations of literacy, but in our practice, in some critical sense of praxis, that sort of play, you know, where it's happening simultaneously.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the Bread and Roses show on a Friday afternoon. You're listening to the Bread and Roses show on WXOJ LP 103.3 FM in Northampton. And we are streaming live at valleyfreeradio.org. My name is Elliot Tarry, your host for today's edition of the Bread and Roses show. What you just heard was the voice, a little teaser of Dr. Pepe Leistina. Sadly, the late Dr. Pepe Leistina, beloved professor of applied linguistics at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. Today's show will be in honor of the work and spirit of Pepe Leistina and his passion to redefine literacy in the 20th century. In fact, redefining literacy in the 20th century is the title of a 2010 lecture by Dr. Leistina at Greenfield Community College, which we will hear on today's program. Pepe Leistina is the author of over 100 published works, including Presence of Mind, Education and the Politics of Deception, Defining and Designing Multiculturalism, Television and Working Class Identity, Intersecting Differences is the subtitle, and a co-editor of the book series Minding the Media. As stated earlier, Dr. Leistina was professor of applied linguistics at UMass Boston's Graduate Studies Program, where he coordinated the Graduate Studies Program and taught courses in cultural studies, critical pedagogy, media literacy, and language acquisition. He was also director of the Center for World Languages and Cultures. But Dr. Pepe Leistina may be more widely known for his documentary film titled Classed Dismissed, produced in collaboration with the Media Education Foundation right here in Northampton, which in 2007 received the Studs Terkel Award for Media and Journalism. Classed Dismissed deconstructs the mass media's portrayal of working class Americans, and we will hear some of that documentary as well later in the show. I should mention here that Pepe Leistina's ties to the Pioneer Valley are much deeper than that relationship to the Media Education Foundation. Pepe was raised in Amherst, Massachusetts, and was a big part of the music scene here in the mid-1980s, and has many friends and family still here as well. He received his doctorate from Harvard University and distinguished himself by critiquing in his dissertation the very educational establishment granting him his advanced degree. More recently, Pepe Leistina traveled to Palestine, where he produced a photo documentary work which eventually traveled throughout the United States and received the 2013 Peacemaker Award. But the topic of the lecture you are about to hear is Redefining Literacy in the 20th Century, in which Dr. Leistina seeks to expand the meaning of literacy at a time then and now of standardized testing and by calls from the right-wing forces in the country to return to the basics of the three R's. By contrast, PEPI seeks to expand the definition to include cultural literacy, critical literacy, media literacy, technical and methodological literacy, and to have all of these woven into early childhood education by employing the theories and praxis of critical pedagogy. Now, I will admit, I had to look up the definition of critical pedagogy, and thank the gods for Wikipedia. So for those who, like me, did not really, were not familiar with the term, critical pedagogy is a philosophy of education and a social movement that combines education and critical theory. First described by Paulo Freire, it has since been developed by Henri Giraud and others as a praxis-oriented education movement guided by passion and principle to help students develop consciousness of freedom, recognize authoritarian tendencies, and connect knowledge to power and the ability to take constructive action. Among its leading figures are Michael Apple, it says, and bell hooks, one of my favorites. So that is the Wikipedia definition of critical pedagogy, which was, of course, a passion of Dr. Lystina. By its very nature, his approach becomes radically political and dangerous to the power structure. Now, let's listen to Dr. PEPI Lystina in a 2010 lecture, but since the audio quality, I'll admit, may not be ideal, I would suggest you listen not so much to every word as much as to PEPI's thought process, its rhythm, passion, and joy, as he coalesces complex facets of modern existence, literacy, culture, and learning into tangible frameworks of understanding.
Walk through what I think needs to be an expanded definition of literacy, functional literacy through. And then what I'm going to do is end up with this idea of critical media literacy. I'm going to show a little chunk of the film that was mentioned that came out from the Media Education Foundation. Just kind of get an idea of how that kind of critique works. But to get there, I want to problematize the whole notion of literacy as it's developed, and certainly since No Child Left Behind has been implemented since 2001, because they have a very strict sort of phonics approach to defining, conceptualizing, and implementing literacy classes via this definition. And the reason I think it's so limited is because this idea of functional literacy is limited simply to the notion of decoding and encoding. For those of us that deal with, you know, literacy every day, that's basic reading and writing. But reading and writing, to the extent that one can look at a text, right, you can look at a piece of paper, you can see there's some insignia, there's some signs on the text, and you can decode those signs. You're able to sort of extract some kind of message from those signs, or that you can encode, right, those signs. You can write. Now, if that's functional literacy, which I think it is, I think that's the basic definition of functional literacy, the question really is that enough? Once a person acquires those skills, is that enough to call that person literate? And my answer, I think that's a rhetorical question, my answer is absolutely no. And This is, let's use a basic example. Cruising up here today, I saw a bumper sticker on the back of the car. Actually, I saw two. One I really liked. The other one was disturbing, but you'll find out ideologically where I'm situated, given which one I was mobilized by towards liking and not liking. The one I'm going to use, it had the peace sign on it, right? And it said, the footprint of the American chicken. And I thought, all right, cool, if these, you know, these triple chins, oh, I shouldn't call them triple chins, I've turned into a triple chin because I've been ball and changing a computer for the last 50 years. But these guys and their cronies down in D.C., right, put these little pieces together and say, well, you know, literacy is an easy thing. All you need to do is know how to decode and encode. And I'm looking at this bumper sticker thinking, it requires a hell of a lot more to understand what this simple little statement is saying. I mean, what else do I need to have to read that bumper sticker? Beyond decoding and encoding. By the way, these folks are always saying we need to get back to the basics. It's like we've never left the basics. That's part and parcel of what the problem is. No one I know, as radical as they go, thinks that we shouldn't be getting back to the basics in the sense that we shouldn't be embracing functional literacy. What I'm saying is we need to expand it. What do I need to expand to read that bumper sticker? Yeah, you're going to need some knowledge of current events, totally. So you're not only going to need functional literacy, you're going to need what we refer to as cultural literacy. You need some background knowledge, right? You need some common associations of information that's been circulated that allow you to read into this apparently simple statement. What kind of current events would I need to know? Exactly. So I mean, that cultural grounding tells me that you can't have some sense of universal literacy via decoding and encoding, some technique or abstract sort of exercise. Literacy is always grounded in some kind of historical, institutional, cultural context. That's the only way to get the meaning from it. The meaning of that bumper sticker is not coming via osmosis or lifting up a rock or dropping out of the sky. It's inscribed through a social process that we're all part and parcel of. But you need to be socialized, apprenticed into that space to start to extract not the sign situation, right? That's arbitrary. But that cultural understanding, those current events. So suddenly it's like, I need to know something about what's going on in the Persian Gulf. More specifically, what's going on in Iraq. But it's interesting that they use the peace sign. Again, the peace sign, you know, sort of looks like the footprint of the American chicken that they're saying. Why the peace sign? What else do I need? Totally. We're pulling from Vietnam, where the peace sign came out of, unless, of course, you believe the Heineken commercial that basically said of some hippie, it was supposed to be Woodstock looking for two fresh Heineys. Right? That could be one cultural context, again, spectacle, diverting you away from the historical specificities through which we can understand, if we're literate, right, what the peace sign is and how it's emerged. What are the historical specificities through which it's emerged? How do we then combine generational forces to see how it's now being misused as what's happening in Iraq? Okay, ideologically, where you situate yourself in this, you brought up many sides of it. It isn't really what's relevant at this point. What's relevant for me is what it's going to require for you to read that bumper sticker. Right? So we need a sense of history. We need cultural literacy in terms of associations. We need a sense of history. And environmental stuff, again, moving out of the 60s, the environmental movement. We know these neoliberals in D.C. can't stand that stuff. Because they want the government off the backs, which again, we need serious literacy to read into, because they really want the government on the backs. They really want, in the name of deregulation, to regulate in their interests. Otherwise, something like NAFTA wouldn't be 980 pages. If it's a North American free trade agreement, it should be no pages. Free trade. Go to Canada, get your drugs, go to Mexico, get whatever you want. No, what it really is, again, which would require the third step of literacy, what I'm calling critical literacy, would require us the ability to not only understand the knowledge that exists, right, the discourses that are in place, but to be able to critically read into those discourses, to get the values and beliefs, the historical specificities within, this is what's key, not universal structuralist notions of literacy, the post-structural notions of literacy through which we start to identify the power relationships that shape that knowledge and get that knowledge circulated throughout society so that we consume it in socializing agencies, whether it's the family, houses of faith, community organizations, or where most of us work, educational institutions. These are major agencies of socialization. These aren't neutral places. People say, oh, they're neutral and democratic places. It's like, you can't be neutral and democratic. Democratic's an ideological position. Right? They're not. They're cultural institutions. What these institutions, I think, need to be doing is embracing a more critical notion of literacy. Right? And I don't mean sort of critical thinking along the lines of abstraction, mathematical equations, and so on. I mean ideological analysis. The ability to read the values and beliefs that are embedded in the knowledge that we wield. Not just to recognize the knowledge, but to start to recognize where that knowledge comes from. Right? So now we've got functional literacy, cultural literacy, and critical literacy. Right? But the key then to ask the question is, well, what these agencies of socialization, right, these sort of houses of cultural production or reproduction, what were the key agencies in that place? And for me, the media is such an important sort of mechanism for being able to circulate information these days in what we're calling the postmodern world. We're saturated by images and messages. So for me, notion of critical pedagogy and critical literacy needs to also have connected to it a component of critical media literacy. That the media is not simply reflective of some reality that exists out there. It's not simply expressive as if, oh, I just wanted to tell this story because it made me feel good. It's also pedagogical. It's radically formative. It's telling us an enormous amount about the world around us. The problem is most of us aren't aware of it, which is where this film goes. What I try to do with the film is say, you know what? When we're watching TV, especially entertainment television, we need to take that entertainment more seriously. We We need a critical media literacy sort of lens through which we entertain ourselves. I think certainly one that needs to be embraced in schools. Not telling kids what to think, but teaching them how to think so that they can look at this world, right, this grand spectacle, and start to look at it and say, what is this telling me about myself? What's it telling me about the community I live in? What's it telling me about race and class and gender and sexuality? All these issues around identity. Because as I argue, this isn't reflected. It's not some mimesis of something that's just out there, some pre-existing entity. It's formative. People make these shows. There are human beings that have been socialized, that are ideologically oriented, that make these shows. And so what I want to do with this is show that, you know what, we need to take our entertainment more seriously. If we're going to redefine literacy in the 21st century, it needs to be a combination, that articulation of functional, cultural, critical, and media literacy. Now, there are two other elements I'm not going to talk about today because we don't have enough time. I think technological literacy is also important. Come on, let's face it. We live in a technologically saturated world. It's a whole other language. You know, I mean, I can ask a seventh grader or a seven-year-old, and they're going to know 10 times more than I do about how to run these programs, how to run your iPod. You know, I'm like a postmodern caveman. I can do, you know, Microsoft Word. Thank goodness they came up with the images. You know, they're like, okay, technological literacy is important. Methodological literacy is really important, and it often gets completely sort of relegated to the margins. Methodological literacy, if you really want to understand where those cultural representations come from, it's how they're generated, right? We're all in institutions of higher education, Greenfield Community College, right? We study, we're exposed to empirical work, right? Research. Research, as you all know, doesn't fall out of the sky. Somebody puts it together. Matter of fact, a real important question to ask when you're checking out research, see who funded it. Do a little bit with your technological literacy, go online, find out who funded it, because what you often find is those experts that we see on television all the time, whether it's Fox, right, Viacom, Disney, right, Time Warner, General Electric, I love it, these are liberal media. Well, not Fox, everybody knows that. The other ones are liberal. It's like these are massive transnational telecommunications corporations that have all kinds of vertical and horizontal relationships. There's nothing liberal about them. I mean, go read what Sumner Redstone and Viacom has to say about the world. These are really conservative, neoliberal characters. But again, you need the critical literacy, the technological literacy to go online to start to read those cultures, see how they all start to go together. This is really, really important if we're going to make substantive change for the 21st century, that we need a population that's much more literate and able to read, as Paulo Freire argued, that social political reality, that political power sort of set relationships, historical sensibilities around us, if we're going to participate in what's supposed to be a democracy, and we're selling ad nauseum to places that most people in this country can't point out on the map. And again, don't believe a word I say. Do your own research. Go ask people where Iraq is. Give them a map. Part of the crime of this whole notion of redefining literacy is that people say, well, no, first you need to teach the basics. Get to that, that's icing on the cake. Get to that later. It's like, there is no later. You don't take a 21-year-old adult and say, suddenly we're going to infuse you with these other elements that we consider to be important, but only at this particular juncture. It's like, for me, K through 12, right from the get-go, when kids are getting access to this, we should have not only a theoretical working definition of these variations of literacy, but in our practice, in some critical sense of praxis, that sort of play, you know, where it's happening simultaneously. That, I think, is really important, rather than get back to the ABCs and the phonics approach, rather than what whole language is sort of trying to bring in, of no cultural associations, and then the limits of whole language of, what about these other elements? So for me, these aren't, I don't conflate them, they're not the same thing. Their articulation comes together, right? They're not one and the same thing, but gosh, they're multiple interconnecting relationships that I think not only need to be understood, certainly in any semblance of a democracy, but need to be embraced and encouraged in these agencies of socialization of schools. Libraries maybe don't really important work. Librarians often get like dissed and off to the side. It's like, what? Your ability to be cultural workers and give access, there's huge power with that. But when people come in, do you work? I mean the abstract you. I don't know what personalizes. Do you work in order to apprentice people into these skills? Because we're not biologically predisposed to them. We might be biologically predisposed as a species to be curious and to be creative. We couldn't survive without it, but not critical. That's an apprenticing process. We have faculties for it, right? Neurophysiologically, we have faculties for it, but we need people like you, like all of you, to be able to find ways, niches, spaces, and places to embrace this stuff and encourage it among, you know, students, regardless of what it is. You're not born with universal literacy skills so that you can suddenly navigate the college library at Greenfield Community College. come to UMass Boston, different context, different space. You might have some tools that you can use in the active sort of transfer process of, I wonder if it works like this. And if it doesn't, you'll figure it out, or you'll have someone help you. But the bottom line is, those are culturally specific entities, and again, you're not born with that stuff. So this notion of just get back to you, everybody is literate in the same way, get back to the ABCs and you'll be fine, it's ludicrous. Because just as soon as I walk in this building, and I'm 43 years old and I've been in these institutions for a long time, I'm going to get lost. My first question, where's the bathroom? It's not because I'm having some synaptic problem, or there are some material situations that got to be, you give a point. It's like, you need to be apprenticed into this, and the literacy is always calling that into, or I should say, should always be calling that into question. Now, especially with this, because the media, again, is such, I mean, I would argue, given especially that young people watch so much more television than they do in terms of time on task, and they spend it in classes, formal educational classes, that we need to take our entertainment far more seriously. Now, the film itself, as it takes up critical media literacy, is actually a three-part series. I picked this part because I sort of already had the data for it, not realizing what I was getting into, because it was 4 years of blood, sweat, and tears. But I'm glad it's out, that it's done, and I'm happy with it, and so on, and working at NBF is great. But the first part, what I was really interested in, is how does news media represent the working class, represent labor, represent us? Right. That's the first one. The second one is how does entertainment represent the working class, labor? Right. And the third one is how does Hollywood film represent labor? Now, those three things, I don't think can be conflated. There's those interpenetrating relationships with the three different animals, right? So we decided that the easiest one to take up at this point is entertainment television. And for me, one of the strategies was, I think, to get people to start to consider the possibility that the world doesn't work the way that they think it does, right? That tolerance of, yeah, maybe I've been taught some things that, maybe they're not true. Maybe the bumper sticker's sending me in a direction that might not be true, which was the counter bumper sticker that I liked. The counter bumper sticker was, I'm trying to find a florist that can ship 2 bushes to Iraq. Now, you can see the ideological tension in there. Now, where you situate yourself, that's up for debate. That's what democracy is about. Debate, dialogue, dissent. Not conformity and coercion, right? And those bumper stickers articulate that space. That's an important space. Again, I'm not trying to, this isn't supposed to be a pedagogy of imposition. I'm not trying to impose on you anything. You think for yourselves. But it's definitely a pedagogy of exposition. To expose my students, for example, my graduate students, to information, to get them to consider it, and to start to develop what you were talking about here, the tools, and those theoretical tools, the ability to theorize, the ability to start to make sense of the world around you, not what's happening. That's just narrative, description, right? That's a form of literacy, but why it's happening. That's theory, that's theorizing. Why and how you think, what happens, that's key to this process of critical literacy. So, I'm going to expose them, my students, or anybody, you, myself, again, we're in this constant process of learning, but I'm going to expose them to the information, and given what they know about the world, I hope they make critical decisions. Like, not just big things like elections, but how they buy their milk, or how they teach their kids, or anything and everything in our everyday lives requires that kind of literacy, that kind of critical literacy of reading, analyzing, drawing your generalizations so that those generalizations inform what your actions are. Right? Unless, of course, we're total hypocrites, like most politicians, where, yes, no child left behind. What a great title. Who the hell wants to leave any children? Anybody in this room want to leave some children behind? or not in Massachusetts, we're an English-only state. English for the children. Who the hell would want English for the children, right? But when you're smart, these folks are cultural studies people. They know how to develop these signs, embed them with ideology, and circulate them so that people say, yeah, that's right. Now, those bleeding liberals, all they want to do is this and this. It's like, the debate's already lost. We just did a radio interview, the guy said that. He said, well, you liberals. And I was like, God, I've been struggling all my life to be sort of a radical pedagogue. And now you link me with, like, Hillary Clinton. who they say she's a radical socialist. Hillary Clinton is a socialist. I'm from another planet. And I don't think I'm extreme. I'm just trying to get people to think. I think that is presupposed in any notion of a participatory democracy. Should be presupposed in any notion of literacy, right? I don't think that's so crazy and loony and let's march up the street with my flag so I can turn you all into a bunch of raving Marxists. Right? This is about simply the tools that you need to develop within what's supposed to be a free flow of information. K-12 education is supposed to be about civic responsibility and civic mindedness. Then what are the very tools that you need to navigate that space? And I'm arguing you need a very sophisticated toolbox of literacy to do this. And unfortunately, as we're converted away, via television, which is more about spectacle and infotainment than it really is about trying to understand who we are in the world and how we've come to that sense and how we navigate that space. It does exactly the opposite. It says, sit on your duff, and most of us do anyway because we're overworked and underpaid and underappreciated, especially teachers. So you're like, you want me to think some more? I just want to be passively entertained, please, for 20 seconds. And I totally understand that. There's nothing wrong with being entertained. The problem is, if entertainment is all we're about, right? If watching the Red Sox, which is done anyway, is all we're about, then there's something wrong. I watch the Red Sox. There's nothing wrong with that. It's to what degree has the literacy in your world been so diverted away that all you're looking for is pleasure and spectacle? These folks want you to have that kind of literacy. What I call dysfunctional literacy. They want you to have that because basically what that does is it moves you to the side and keeps you from getting involved in the very political process and the very dangerous questions that they don't want you to ask. All in the name of democracy. Remember, we're trying to democratize Iraq and the rest of the world because we're using fascist dictatorships to do it. And all these other countries that aren't democratic countries, again, that requires the critical literacy, the cultural literacy we back up. So with this level of spectacle, I'm entertained by some of these shows that you can see. I think Doug Heffernan on King Queen's a funny dude. That's not where the problem lies. The problem lies if that's the only image that you get of a working class identity and it falls into an historical pattern since the advent of television of representing the working class as a bunch of buffoons, people who are disinterested in education, they're disinterested in their children's education, they have bad family values, they have bad hygiene, they're not interested in moving up in the world, right? And this is across race, right? Gender, and certainly sexuality that the film takes up. I'm just going to show you this little chunk of it that's called Class Clowns, that again is supposed to be, as producers, directors, and certainly CEOs of these corporations tell us, it's supposed to be just about entertainment. Chill out. Come on. Get a giggle. There was one student told me, I gave this talk in this Catholic boys' school, and he said, come on, it's just Disney, for crying out loud. It's fun. You know? And I'm like, yeah, sure, that's okay. Have fun. There's nothing wrong with having fun. But as a pedagogical force, why is it that the story of Pocahontas, for example, if it happens to be the one that's circulated that young kids can express, is the Disney version. It's not the A&E version, which is a little more progressive. It's certainly not the MEF version, right? The Mickey Mouse, what do we call it? The Mickey Mouse Monopoly. It's like, you're not going to find that on mainstream television. You're not going to find the A&E one on mainstream television. What you are going to find is the Disney version. So that needs to be problematized. We need among children to develop and nurture a language of critique, to go in and say, I'm not just being entertained, I'm also simultaneously being educated. And so my final definition of literacy for the 21st century takes that component very seriously. Doesn't mean I don't like to be entertained. Look at me, I love to be entertained. It means we nonetheless need to take our entertainment seriously to realize it's a major pedagogical force. In terms of cultural literacy, it has a huge impact on what kids develop and wield. 38 million people in this country live in poverty. Right? The poverty threshold is about $10,217. I don't know how you do with that money, but there ain't much that I can do with that money. You have kids, you got all kinds of bills and responsibilities. There's 3.9 million homeless people in this country. 39% of them are kids. You can't say they're just lazy workers, these are kids, right? 44 million people that don't have health insurance. And I can go on and on and on these statistics of where do these representations of the grand, glorious sort of idea that Americans are doing fine come from? That's the whole point of the critical media literacy. A lot of it's circulating among sort of that medium that needs to be taken up. I think definitely needs to be taken up. I mean, think about it. People were drooling 2 days ago because the stock market went through the roof. They broke a record, right? It broke 12,000. But economically, that's pretty amazing. So all of a sudden, circulated everywhere is the economy is doing really, really well. Well, you need to have critical literacy to go in and say, wait a minute, 92% of the stocks in the United States are owned by less than 10% of the people. Who's really making the money off of that 12,000 mark, right? 90% of political contributions come from less than 1% of the population in this country. Who's really going to circulate the message of what is grand and glorious around here? Because the bottom line is, the United States is $8.3 trillion in debt. What about the deficit? The deficit's child's play. It's about $450 billion. That's just trade issues. That's child's play. Debt, what we owe, $8.3 trillion. This current administration has borrowed more money than all of the other presidents combined to support what they're calling size of government and the old fiscal responsibility that Republicans always embrace. Now, the Democrats belong to the same party. They're also a big business party. Don't get me wrong here. Bill Clinton was a moderate Republican. All the big decisions that he made were all important decisions, I should say, that he made were big business decisions. NAFTA, some drug enforcement, the 1996 Telecommunications Act, the 1996 Welfare Act. That's why he can hang with Bush Sr. now, and really not that far apart. Such a limited ideological spectrum. They want to make it seem like the Democrats and Republicans, they just don't get along. I was listening to Carl Rove last night on TV. Those Democrats, it's like, give us real circulation of real issues like that $8.3 trillion, which, by the way, these guys can't stand the commies. China owns $1 trillion of our national debt. $1 trillion. I ain't talking trillion. Japan has a little bit over $2 trillion of that debt. These are guys that are not interested in the United States. They're not interested in patriotism. They're certainly not interested in any kind of participatory democracy. But again, to have youth understand that so they can situate themselves within this grander politic, I'm arguing they need a more sophisticated sense of literacy than simply giving functional literacy, again, basic decoding and encoding, and all of this goes away. All the isms, racism, sexism, homophobia, classism, linguicism, xenophobia, all this stuff magically disappears. You know why? Because you can decode the phonics card, by the way. Do your research, again, methodological literacy. Do your research on who controls the education industrial complex. It's a $600 billion a year complex. And you start to look at Harper Brace, Pearson, McGraw-Hill, right? McGraw-Hill is buddy-buddies with the Bush family since the 30s. They used to vacation together down in Florida in this very exclusive, I'm sure it was, I'm sure there were soldiers at the gates, you know, neighborhood. Well, look at McGraw-Hill, he's the first guy in the White House when George W. Bush, right, Jr., was in office. The first day, Harold McGraw-Hill comes on in. They've had an incredibly profound relationship because McGraw-Hill has, in large part, a monopoly on a multi-billion-dollar business in the United States to sell us crappy materials, crappy assessment. None of this has been proved, right? In this grand accountability and efficiency, we need more accountability. These corporations are not held accountable for the things that they're selling us. It's a really, really interesting form of class warfare. Take tax money, buy private stuff, call it public, it's crappy education, so people come out with crappy skills, then you blame them for those crappy skills, so you can relegate them to crappy jobs and pay them minimum wage, which is $5.15. Back to the poverty threshold, I'm no mathematician, 40 hours a week at $5.15, you're about 200 bucks over the poverty threshold. Now who's there within the representation force of coin? What these are not hard-working people, it's lazy people. These are people that get what they deserve. You know why? Because all they want is sort of self-pleasure, sit on their duffs. That's what the working class is. Disarticulated, completely scripted, completely outside of the fact that, you know, wages have been stagnant since the mid-1970s. Right? Productivity is up. Hugely so, right? The profits are through the roof. Since 1975, they're 758% up. That's the story I want to hear on the news, but I'd be naive to think that private news, not public airwaves, which they belong to you, the FCC developed them with your tax, well, we probably weren't around, your tax monies, right? They're supposed to be yours. Sorry. they're supposed to be there. It's actually, there's a binding, but you know, there's a serious agreement that says these folks aren't supposed to be just there to entertain you. They're also supposed to take a substantive chunk of time to educate you, and they're not fulfilling that. They're actually breaking the law. But again, what they are fulfilling is all this other fluff over here. I mean, I hear more about Paris Hilton than I do about what the hell's going on in Lebanon. Now, every time I just got back from Turkey. I'm actually off to India. Man, every time I turn on those, you know, those programs, I'm like, wow, real news. This is bizarre. It's not Mrs. Jones's cat up the tree 20 times a day, because that's cheap news that these private interests don't want to spend the money. A, they don't want to educate you, because then you're going to start to ask dangerous questions about who they are and how they shape the society in the first place. But B, it's like, I need some information. I can't participate in the society without information. And I don't mean just Pepe's information. What I mean is a diversity of information, right? A free flow of information, so that when we do develop those combination of literacies, including information literacy, thank you for adding that, that we have the skills to say, given what I know about the world, I'm going to vote here, I'm going to vote here, I'm going to buy my milk here. Right? So for me, this isn't just about an abstract educational practice. It's not just about grandiose, you know, which General Motors coming today. It's both of those and everything in between. This is not just for academics. This is for anybody who's going to participate in a democratic society. And these pedagogies of diversion they'll throw on now, I'll just play a little piece of it. You know, they're not into that. I mean, as Chomsky argued, it's not a conspiracy theory. This isn't some grand conspiracy. They're protecting their own interests. Anybody would do this. Then we have to say, okay, what are their interests? Those are the critical questions.
Are listening to the Bread and Roses show on WXOJLP 103.3 FM in Northampton and streaming live on valleyfreeradio.org. And we just heard a song by a young Pepe Laistina, somewhere around late 80s, song titled Sound Escape, I believe, although it may be Up on the Roof, not sure. With Pepe Laistina on vocals and lead guitar, John Cruz on backup vocals, and Tim Biggins on piano, among others, from a popular valley band of that era, the 80s, late 80s, 90s, FC Pohaku, was a popular band led by John Caban and Johnny Cruz. And this music of Pepe Lystina comes to us courtesy of Mr. KK, Chris Kendrickson. Also, thanks to John Caban and Joe Boyle for helping get these archival tapes to the studio here. Before that, we were listening to a lecture by Dr. Lystina delivered in 2010 at GCC. And we will continue by listening to a portion of Pepe's award-winning documentary on the media portrayal of working-class Americans titled Class Dismissed. Dr. Lystina used this portion in his discussion of media literacy.
In order to reinforce its middle-class ideology, television must account for the members of the working class who haven't made it. TV reproduces the deeply ingrained belief that workers' inadequacies are to blame for their lack of advancement. In reality, most Americans do not change their class position, and the boundaries of social class are now more restrictive than ever.
For a very long time, I believe ending in the early 1980s or the late 1970s, it was possible for a quarter of the working class to move beyond its class origins into professional and managerial categories. And that developed into both a mythology as well as an ideology, which the mythology was that everybody in America can gain social mobility. The ideology was that it's a personal question.
Because there's such a strong ideology that says that anybody can make it. So if you haven't made it and you're not wealthy, something wrong with you.
And so the idea that we are who we are because of what we have done, I think is so limited. It's not completely wrong that people are individuals and have responsibility and have possibilities and potential. But that's limited and constrained and influenced by the social circumstances in which we grow up.
Television representations either perpetuate the idea that the cream always rises to the top, or they reinforce stereotypes about workers' failure to succeed due to their inferior qualities, such as bad taste, lack of intelligence, reactionary politics, poor work ethic, and dysfunctional family values.
One of the flaws that's supposedly characteristic of the working class, you know, that's widely circulated in popular culture, of course TV plays an important role in that circulation, pertains to taste, lifestyle, and leisure. And the stereotypical image that we get is, you know, a bunch of slobs sitting around on some cheesy couch. They're drinking beer, preferably brown bottle or canned beer, you know, staring at the tube. They love junk culture. You know, we don't get the sense that they're deserving of the finer things in life. You know, they wouldn't appreciate it anyway.
Can't try to save money by not having the right beer. You know, you can skip having medical insurance, you can buy everything you own to swap me, but the right beer is what makes living like this possible.
This is something that I think is expressed through the idea of taste. You know, it's something that you either have or you don't. Well, no one either has it or they don't. Everybody acquires it.
I mean, if you are, a lower-income person, you're not going to be buying micro-brew beers. You're going to be more likely be buying something like Budweiser or even a cheaper brand. You may not be getting artisan bread from the local bakery. You may be getting Wonder Bread or something like that. That has to do with economics.
You know, being working class seems kind of like a lifestyle choice where people, you know, like pink flamingos and tacky furniture in their house and don't have much taste.
Just trying to give your family a little culture. Bet if I shoved it in a hot pocket and smothered it in Velveeta the floor, you would be out back wrestling over it.
Because if people choose to have lower incomes, when class, in reality, is powerfully structured by social forces.
When they do try to move out of the space and hobnob with the middle and upper classes, it's made really laughable because they're so awkward in this new environment. They don't have the cultural capital to navigate it. And TV plays off this, in particular sitcoms.
Miss Shirley Feeney and Miss Laverne DeFazio.
Tip this guy on the way out. You'll get it later.
It's really nice of you to have us over.
Oh.
Yeah, thanks. This is for you. Scotch. Hope you like it.
Like it? He loves it. Big scotch guy right here.
Scotch is great. Love the drink, love the tape.
So, what do you think of the new joint?
I don't get all this eyeball stuff. What are they supposed to represent? Eyeballs?
It's Paul Moe. Postmodern. Yeah, all right. Weird for the sake of weird.
Oh! One way to fit into this upper class world is to get a personal makeover. There's a slew of reality shows that are dedicated to this process.
I want to train in my blue collar life.
I want to be him.
What will happen when this average Joe is transformed into a multi-millionaire?
Let's say Joe Millionaire, for example. Where you take these working class guys and you give them the necessary social skills and etiquette to pass as money. You know, and there's a bunch of other shows that are about physical transformation. This idea that bodily perfection, you know, leads to upward mobility. And not only that, now, you know, you can make over your house, you can make over your car. Then there's Queer Eye for the Straight Guy that goes for the whole package, the house and the body. You know, it's one of those rare shows of gay representation. Stereotypically, it's white and male and upper middle class.
Television is doing with Fab Five what culture has done with gay men for a very long time, which is in a sense pushing them to the precincts of taste where they're allowed to be.
Doesn't he look amazing?
That's great.
He looks better. Yep. You know, it's tucked in.
Those pants fit really well.
The pants are great.
Where, historically, could gay men be both employed and openly gay, for the most part in the style trades? And so I want to be careful with critics' dismissal of the program as just a product placement orgy.
I also think that the critique of Queer Eye comes partly because the made-over people are straight men. And, you know, straight men historically have been the arbiters of all things serious. And they're, in a sense, being reduced as people who have to buff their nails in order to be more acceptable lovers or employees. In contrast, women have long been accustomed to the idea that you need to better appoint yourself in order to expect social mobility. So we might ask the question, what is it about contemporary labor circumstances that demand that of men as well, rather than saying, what is it about gay men that can't stop sort of selling things to the rest of us?
None of this changes a person's class position, or the economic conditions that created their situation in the first place. And if you want a real class makeover, you're going to have to radically change the economic system. That's a reality show I'd love to see. Another debilitating characteristic of this group of people, according to the stereotype, is that working class men lack intelligence.
One day they're going to look back and realize how stupid their father is. Or more likely, they'll have my genes and be so stupid they won't even realize it.
You know, it's obvious they weren't good students. They often fumble the language. And a lot of basic stuff just goes right over their heads.
It's gotta be a doctor. That's what they call a MD. What's his name? Mr. Doctor, I reckon.
The classic character of the lovable but laughable buffoon that's still very much with us today is played by Jackie Gleason in The Honeymooners. And the character of Ralph Cramden. He's this city bus driver who hates his job. He's loud and blustery, and he's always coming up with these harebrained schemes. And the real joke is, we know that he's not that smart. He has this sidekick, Ed Norton, who's this dim-witted but lovable, you know, happy-go-lucky sewer worker.
I'm telling you, pizzas will manhole covers, the sewer will be a paradise.
These class clowns get reproduced in the 1960s with the Flintstones. Even though it's set back in the Stone Age, Fred's the direct descendant of Ralph Cramden, and Barn is definitely the son of Ed Norton. And what follows is a whole parade of dumb working class guys. Stupidity is the brunt of the joke.
What do you do?
I run CBS.
Ah, CBS, nice. My wife shops there. In fact, she just picked up a couple 12 packs of Charmin and saved a bundle.
The Honeymooners was also an important prototype for a particular gender dynamic. Because these guys are so lacking in common sense, and the wives are obviously smarter, it's the women who end up ruling the roost.
Now you listen to me, Ralph. You are not going bowling.
I gotta go, Alice. I promised the guys.
The guys? What about me, Ralph? What about your job? What about our future?
And so what we end up with is a reversal of traditional gender roles, where these guys are essentially incapable of taking their place at the head of the household.
I just gambled away my paycheck, that's all.
You lost that too? Ronnie, we don't have money to gamble.
I know, that's why
Trina, I have a problem.
You do not have a problem. I have a problem. I'm married to an idiot.
That's, I mean, Antonio Gramsci was onto this when he died under fascism, right, in prison with the notion of hegemony. You don't necessarily have to have a gun in somebody's head. We did that too. But you need to control the psyche. You need to control the imagination. You need to control public memory so that you actually get people through that kind of circulation to consent to their own exploitation and subordination. That's brilliant. Because you don't do it necessarily with physical force. You do it with ideology. I mean, that's why Goering subliminally said, when I hear the word culture, I reach for my gun. Because the Nazi Germany knew how this worked. I mean, Goering was obviously as well known for his propaganda industry. They knew how dangerous culture is. Culture is primary, and we need to take that up. But your example is a perfect one of critical literacy, of saying, yeah, we need functional literacy, we need cultural literacy, we need background information, right? We need these other forms, technological, information, methodological, but that critical component is the one that is most frequently pulled out of the equation. And I think that's not random, that's strategic. You don't want a bunch of young kids asking really critical questions about the very people whose position of power is going to be subverted once they realize that Birkenstock environmental nonsense that they construct, not that Birkenstocks are nonsense, you don't want to go to the representation, is just that, it's neoliberal nonsense. I'll end on this, because I just read this piece where, they just talk about the environmental point, where they were talking about, yes, but the natural wetlands have actually been increased by this new woman that they put in charge. You do a little bit of information work, and you find out, you know how it's been increased? How have the wetlands in this country been increased? It's pretty dramatic.
They've redefined the definition of a wetland.
Totally. To include golf course ponds, dysfunctional swamps, and this one's the real kicker, swimming pools. How is that possible? Critical literacy is really important in the 21st century. Thanks for coming. I really appreciate it.
the singing and guitar of Pepe Leistina, recorded circa 1987 or 88, a song entitled Road to the Reason Why, a title that may have presaged his journey to critical pedagogy. And before that, a short excerpt from Dr. Leistina's award-winning documentary, Class Dismissed, which is available from the Media Education Foundation or online, and books or publications by Dr. Leistina are available online from Amazon as well. And I should say here, in the spirit of media literacy, that Class Dismissed is produced by the Media Education Foundation, and that could key you to a possible slant in their outlook. The voices and commentators you heard in order of appearance, Ed Asner is the narrator of the film. Sociology professor Stanley Aronowitz, author and activist Barbara Ehrenreich, and from the Center for Labor Studies, Michael Zweig, then Pepe Leistina, and also Professor Lisa Henderson from UMass, and Pepe again. Just a word about the last thought in Pepe's lecture is, I believe, of extreme importance, the concept that culture trumps politics, whether referring to developmental issues, education, literacy, or public opinion and action. Also, Pepe's passing reference to, I believe it was Edward Bernays, the father of public relations, is also a reference to manufacturing consent and a need, as Dr. Leistina says, to take our entertainment seriously. And that does it for this edition of the Bread and Roses Show. In loving memory of Pepe Leistina, may his torch be passed and brilliance keep on blazing. Anagawahe, Pepe, till we meet again. Marching at the dawn of the day. All the darkened kitchens, the mill of gray, all touched by the radiance that the sun discloses. Oh, hear the people singing bread and roses. Oh, hear the people singing bread and roses. As we come marching, so many women.